In this year's gubernatorial race, the candidates are not going to the middle. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Ron DeSantis and Andrew Gillum represent two very different ideologies, with little effort to appear moderate. Today we're going to hear from State Representative Jeanette Nunez, the Lieutenant Governor candidate running on the ticket with Ron DeSantis, and we're going to learn more about what their campaign represents. Also, we're going to sit down with a panel of book lovers to discuss this month's Sundial Book Club title, The Veins of the Ocean. One of our book club members, by the way, is joining us for that discussion about immigration, familial death, and a whole lot more. Then we're going to meet an Ellie Award winner. That's a local award supporting artists in Miami. Today's guest is putting together a book about a Hialeah man who has taken 30 years of trash and turned his home into an art exhibit. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. 1 week from today, voters across the state of Florida are going to elect the state's newest governor. The differences between Democratic Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum and Republican Ron DeSantis could not be more stark. The conservative Mr. DeSantis has aligned himself with both President Trump and Governor Rick Scott on numerous policy platforms, including tax cuts and the economy, school security measures, combating the state's algal bloom, and a whole lot more. Mayor Gillum has championed a progressive platform of Medicaid expansion, a higher minimum wage, and major criminal justice reform. Now, today we're going to meet one of the running mates. Florida Speaker of the House Tempore, Representative Jeanette Nunez, is campaigning alongside DeSantis and would become the state's first Cuban-American as lieutenant governor. Nunez has been a conservative force in the state legislature and argues the DeSantis-Nunez ticket would continue the state's economic growth. Now, we've invited Mr. DeSantis to be on the program numerous times, and that invitation remains open. We've also invited Democratic Lieutenant Gubernatorial Candidate Chris King to join the program on Thursday. Now, the conversation that we had with Ms. Nunez was recorded yesterday and is broadcast without edits. Mrs. Nunez, what role do politicians have in trying to sway the tone of rhetoric that's been so vitriolic these last couple of years?
Certainly. Well, I think obviously politicians have a constituency that they're responsible to, and that includes their tone and their rhetoric. And so I've always conducted myself in a very professional manner. I like to stick to the issues. Unfortunately, sometimes political rhetoric does have its place in politics, and that sometimes dissuades voters, particularly those that are apathetic or disappointed with the tone. But I think it's important that we focus on the issues, and that's what Ron DeSantis and I are focused on right now towards the end of the campaign trail, as you can imagine.
When you consider the arrest of Cesar Sayoc, who was sending pipe bombs in the mail, then Robert Bowers, the shooter in Pittsburgh this weekend, what can you say to Florida voters right now that you and Ron DeSantis will do to keep us safe?
Well, certainly. First of all, those two acts were atrocious. We condemn them. We're saddened by the loss of life. And certainly we want to make sure that Florida voters know that Ron DeSantis and I are focused on their safety and well-being. And that's important because we can talk about all the other issues, education, economy, healthcare. But if you're not safe in your own community, then all those other issues are for naught. And so that's why we're proud that the PBA and sheriffs throughout the state of Florida have endorsed us, because they know Ron as someone that has served in the Navy. He's worn the uniform. He's someone that has protected us, made sure that he's focused on the safety and well-being of this country. He's taken the oath. He's made sure that when he got out, he was serving as a prosecutor, someone that was putting people behind bars, working with law enforcement. And so he has a history. He has a record of safety, commitment to safety, and making sure that our folks, our men and women that wear the uniform, that serve and protect, that they're standing with us because they know that we're going to stand with them.
So we're going to talk about safety, and one of those issues is going to come back up again in the next legislature, which is the issue of guns. I mean, you have the Pittsburgh shooting, the Parkland shooting. That brought up the issue of gun legislation. What do you think happens in the next legislation, and where does the DeSantis campaign stand on the gun debate?
Well, certainly I was in the legislature when we had that terrible tragedy in Parkland, and we worked with both sides of the aisle to make sure that we could come up with common sense legislation that will keep our children safe. I think, again, as a mother of three, I'm singularly focused on safety and well-being in our community. And I think that's something that we need to continue to talk about, continue to work towards.
Did the law go far enough, or do you think that, would you have done anything differently?
No, I think that the law struck a really important balance. And you can see that by some of the discourse on both sides, right? So I think you see what we were focused on, which was really ensuring we have a huge problem in this community, in this state, with mental health crises. We see that day in and day out. And so we're focused on really tackling the issue from multiple fronts. It's not just about the issue of mental safety or school security or providing additional resources. I mean, it's a comprehensive issue. It's something that requires comprehensive thought. And I think that it's important that we continue to talk about it, but in a way that's going to protect Second Amendment rights, but also provide the assurances to the parents that want to make sure that when they drop their kids off at school, that they can pick them up healthy and happy.
So we talk about security. I just want to clarify that was the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Security Act. Now, the issue of gun violence. You and Mr. DeSantis were at a fundraiser with the Pollock family. Andrew Pollock, he's the father of Parkland victim Meadow Pollock, and he's taken a sharp stance on school security. Whether we're talking about synagogues or schools, give me an idea of what that security should look like. I mean, again, what the new law says that schools need to have at least one resource officer at least on hand. But what do you think? You're, as you said, you're a mother. What do you want to see that would make schools safe?
Well, certainly, I think the important component of school safety with regards to the resource officers or the police officers that are there, I think that that's an important component. We want to make sure that we have the law enforcement officers that are going to protect our children in the event of a circumstance like Parkland. But again, it goes beyond just having people on the ground, because as we know, the individual on the ground in Parkland failed those children and those families. And so it's not just a false sense of security by having officers there, but we have to talk about what are the policies at the local level, at the school board level, that allowed a monster like the individual that committed that heinous crime to really run rampant. There were so many red flags. And so I think that that issue needs to be addressed. They had a program in place to sort of sweep under the rug some of the problems that that monster was emanating.
And the Promise program.
Yeah, the Promise program. And I think that obviously we need to make sure that we're addressing issues head on.
And what about physically? Physically in the campuses? I mean, we've had this debate about metal detectors, locking a lot of doors, putting fences around schools if they don't already have it. I mean, what do you think we need to do?
Well, certainly there needs to be some hardening of schools, particularly those that have an open campus. I think that there's a lot more discussions that we need to have, whether it's at the legislative level in tandem with our school board partners, to make sure that they have the resources to provide that level of physical hardening. There are some campuses that are more secure than others. I think that's just a reality because of the construction or because of when they were built. I went to a Jewish day school recently, and as you know, we've provided some additional funding for security, particularly for the Jewish day schools, because of the risks that they have. And they were talking to me about all the measures that they take. And so I think it's important, again, whether it's a synagogue or whether it's a school, it's important that we really look at this comprehensively. And the laws that we passed this past year really look to trying to avoid someone that has an issue with mental illness, domestic violence, trying to make sure that that individual does not have access to a gun, because ultimately the individuals that are committing these crimes have no business having a gun to be able to perpetrate the massacre that we've seen, unfortunately, over the last couple of years.
I want to come back to this question of politicians and rhetoric and what we've seen. Are you concerned in any way that the president's rhetoric is fueling political polarization? I mean, you look at the rally Mr. DeSantis had recently, and there were shouts of lock him up, talking about Mr. Gillum, the same thing they said about Hillary Clinton in 2016. I mean, what are your thoughts about what politicians should and should not be saying?
Well, certainly Ron DeSantis didn't say that. And I've seen him in various forums, try to dissuade things like that, because, again, that doesn't really help the situation. I think what we're focused on and what Ron's focused on is making sure voters understand the issues. What is our platform? What do we stand for? What do we want to accomplish? And yes, unfortunately, the rhetoric sometimes gets a little heated on both sides, let's be honest. And so what we want to do is make sure that people understand that Ron DeSantis and I are focused on issues.
Do people want to talk about the issues, or do they just want to go and they want to get angry? Whatever side they're on, do they just want to get angry?
Well, I can't speak for what everyone wants to do or can do or will do at a rally.
What do you do when you're in a situation like that and the crowd is going one way, but you want to talk about an issue?
Well, I certainly hold myself accountable for what I say. I can't hold everybody in a rally or an event or a forum accountable, but I won't partake in things that I think are going to create a situation that may be unsafe or divisive. I think it's important that we focus again on the issues.
Why did you accept the invitation to join the Ron DeSantis campaign?
Well, it was certainly an honor to be asked. It was an issue that I needed to discuss with my family. As you can imagine, I have three children and my husband, and they all had various opinions on what I should or shouldn't do. And so once we really looked at the situation, once we looked at the magnitude of this campaign, you know, I firmly believe that this race is, in my lifetime, the most important race in the history of my lifetime. And I say that not because I'm on the ticket, although people may say, oh, selfishly, she's saying that because she's on the ticket. But honestly, I say that because of the stark divide between the platform, the vision, the ideology of both candidates. And so I really am concerned for Florida's future. I really am concerned with some of the policies that Andrew Gillum has in place for Florida and the downward spiral that we can see as a state, given what he wants to do and what he's hoping to accomplish.
Now, I'm going to talk about issues here, but I do have to ask this question. I mean, in 2016, you were supporting the Rubio campaign for president. Did you tweet the following? Wake up, Florida voters. Trump is the biggest con man. #supportsKKK.
Yes. And I'll tell you, that's a great lesson for my children when they're tweeting. I was supporting Senator Marco Rubio, longtime friend of Senator Rubio and his family. And sometimes campaigns get very heated, and sometimes we say things that certainly should not be tweeted about. And so I've moved on. I've put that in the past, and I'm focused on Florida and making sure that we are supporting issues that are going to move Floridians forward.
Is the DeSantis-Nunez campaign, though, is it connecting itself to the ideologies of the policies of Trump, or are you trying to separate yourself?
No, I think we firmly support the things that the president has done. If you look at the tax cuts, if you look at just recently, he signed a historic legislation that's going to bring much needed funding for our environment. And that's something that Ron has focused on in terms of his ability to get things done for Florida. It does nothing, again, speaking to the rhetoric and the politics that you mentioned earlier, it does nothing to say you're running on a campaign to impeach Trump. It does nothing for everyday Floridians. How are you going to work with the federal government? How are you going to work with the administration to bring down much needed funding for the Everglades, funding for our military footprint, funding for transportation, which we all know in South Florida is very important given our traffic situation. So it does nothing to campaign on an impeach Trump agenda when you're not going to be able to deliver for millions of Floridians that really need desperately that federal funding to come down to Florida.
So we have invited Mr. DeSantis on the program. We heard from Mr. Gillum. We wanted the voters to get to know who he is. So help us understand, what is the DeSantis campaign about? And, you know, I mean, it just briefly tell me, what exactly is it going to do for Florida?
Well, again, I think if you look at our policies, we're looking to make sure that Florida continues its economic progress. Over the last 8 years, we've been able to reduce taxes upwards of $10 billion and create an economic climate that is not only bringing record number of businesses, but certainly record number of transplants from other states that have tried the tax and spend policies that Andrew Gillum wants to implement here and has failed. And we see that because 1,000 people a day are moving to Florida from states like New York, states like California, because they recognize that tax and spend is never going to be beneficial to its residents.
Is it about continuing what Governor Scott's been doing over the last 8 years?
I believe so. It's not just continuing, but making sure that we're focused on what are the issues that we need to tackle over the next decade. And I think Ron has been very vocal on issues like vocational training and providing opportunities for our students. I have a daughter that's in college, and so I hope that when she graduates, she's able to find a high-paying, high-skilled, high-wage job for her. And I think that's important for all of our students, that they recognize that our policies are going to flourish business, to come to Florida, grow and thrive.
This has been one of the criticisms of the Governor Scott camp, administration, is that, yes, jobs have grown, the economy has grown, but a lot of jobs are low paying jobs. So what are you going to do about bringing in? I mean, because, look, I get it, it's a tourism state. So it's a lot of retail. It's a lot of tourism jobs. We're talking about, you know, working in restaurants and so forth. But what is part of the DeSantis policy that's going to attract high-paying jobs.
Well, that's something we've touched on quite a bit. Ron DeSantis and I are looking to bring additional sectors into Florida, sectors that have not traditionally spent time here or have decided to locate their businesses here. And some of those sectors include tech. Technology is huge. As we all know, it's something that I think Florida is well-positioned, particularly with some of the federal tax regulations and some of the tax reductions that we saw, but also the financial services sector, which is very large here in South Florida and also in North Florida. I think there's a lot of opportunity to grow because, yes, while our opponent wants to say that the reason the unemployment is so low is because people are working multiple jobs, which has been discounted. Certainly anyone that understands economic policy understands that that's not what they're counting. But I think it's important that we focus on opportunities that don't currently exist here in Florida. And we know multiple corporations that have looked at Florida because of our positive economic climate, because our tax rate is so low. If Andrew Gillum gets a hold of what he wants to do with our corporate tax rate, we will be the high tax capital of the South, higher than New York, and that's concerning.
I'm speaking with State Representative Jeanette Nunez, a Republican Florida House Speaker pro tempore. She's the Lieutenant Governor candidate running alongside Republican Ron DeSantis for governor. Voters will decide next Tuesday between Mr. DeSantis and Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum for the state's next governor. So part of it is attracting big companies to Florida. What about entrepreneurs? South Florida right now ranked one of the best in startup. But what about what? I haven't heard a lot about, you know, the people who are already here who want to start.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's important. I've spent a lot of time in my current capacity as state representative. I've met with some folks that are startups and met with different small businesses and mid-sized businesses and large businesses. I think if you look at it in a macro level, it's important that we realize that an increase in taxes is not good for anyone. It's not good for the everyday workers, hardworking Floridians. It's not good for small businesses, and it's certainly not good for large businesses. And so we're focused on making sure that we're able to provide a climate that's going to allow businesses that currently exist here to grow and to hire more people, allow businesses that are looking to move to relocate to Florida. And we're looking for every Floridian to be able to thrive under our economic policies.
And obviously one of the big conversations, as you know, and you being in the legislature, the debate about the minimum wage. And so, I mean, what's the stance? I mean, should the minimum wage go up? There's the argument that it could hurt businesses, but the workers are saying, look, especially here in South Florida, you know this, you can't live on the minimum wage.
Well, certainly if you look at it and you look at the minimum wage and what Andrew Gillum is saying, he wants to make it to 15. Here's what's going to happen. And I've talked, again, to many businesses, small businesses, mid-sized businesses, businesses that are mandated. And we've seen Amazon take a policy position to do that voluntarily. And I applaud them. I think that's great. And I think that's a competitive advantage that we're going to have here in South Florida and also throughout Florida. But if you mandate, if government mandates a $15 minimum wage, I'll tell you what's going to happen. People's hours will be cut. Jobs will be lost because at the end of the day, when they look at it, they're going to look at what is the opportunity for them to grow their business. And if they're not going to be able to absorb that minimum wage increase, I think it's going to create a problem. It's the law of unintended consequences. And we see it far too often in Tallahassee, and we see it far too often here locally. And so I applaud businesses that are taking that mantra up. I applaud businesses that are looking to provide a better wage and salary for their employees. But whenever government gets involved, somehow it always finds a way to screw things up. And I think it's important that we allow businesses to flourish. And the way to do that is to make sure that we provide a low tax state, which we've been able to do.
There are a lot of things I want to get to here. Let's move over to the environment. This is something that has come up in both debates. Mr. DeSantis talking about red tide, but I haven't heard what's the plan. How do we deal with the red tide, with the algal blooms that have now pretty much hit all coasts?
Well, certainly on both sides, you've got the blue-green algae on one side and the red tide on another. And so I think what Ron wants to do and what he's looking to do is make sure that south of the lake, we're able to provide that clean water to then go out to the estuaries on the St. Lucie and the Calasahatchie estuaries and make sure that that water does not flow down and create additional challenges for blue-green algae and red tide. I think if you look at what Ron has said, is he wants to make sure that our water quality standards are higher, that people that are in the South Florida Water Management District and water management districts throughout are qualified people that understand. Ron has taken a position in terms of his campaign of not accepting sugar donations. And that's something he did from the primary, and that's something he's continued to do. And so he does that not because he feels like there's, you know, there's a big attack on one way or the other. He does that because he feels it's important that voters understand that he is not beholden to any one industry. He is beholden to making sure that our environment is protected for generations to come. The other thing I mentioned previously is he wants to make sure that he works with the federal government to bring the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been promised to us over the course of the last few decades that have yet to come to Florida to restore Everglades and Biscayne Bay. And so I think there's a lot of things that he's working on. He has a track record, and he has someone that has the will to do it.
And beyond not accepting any campaign dollars from Big Ag, how do you hold Big Ag accountable?
Well, I think it's important, again, when we look at water quality standards and we look at the septic to sewer issue and we look at all the different things from a state perspective that we can do. I think Ron's going to be positioned to be very vocal and very involved in that, working with the legislature. I think when you look at some of the issues with our beach renourishment, and it's really a comprehensive issue. It's not just a water quality issue, right? There's so much more that goes into it, but Ron understands it. He understands that we have to be committed to the science behind it, and he understands that he needs to deliver on the environment for future generations of Floridians, because really our environment is our lifeblood. You know, again, I mentioned in terms of our economy and all those other things, but our environment really is integrally linked to our economic future and our livelihood.
We talk about the environment. We talk about how the environment impacts us. You know, we had Hurricane Michael smash through the panhandle not too long ago. Last year it was Hurricane Irma. This adds a lot of cost to the state. It adds a lot of cost to homeowners. But, you know, Florida being positioned where it is, I mean, we are maybe have the advantage over any other state, and we've learned how to strengthen our building codes and in dealing with the aftermath of hurricanes. Yet you look at what happened after Irma, now after Michael. I mean, what could we be doing better? What is the DeSantis governorship promise that it could do better to help Floridians deal with these things?
Last year after Irma, I was asked to chair a House committee on hurricane preparedness and response. And so we spent about 20 hours taking testimony from all the different stakeholders, really looking at every aspect of the storm, both pre and post storm. We recognize that Irma was a very unique storm in terms of the number of evacuations and in terms of sort of the way that it shifted from one area to the next. And it was a very difficult storm. Obviously, we looked at what are the things that we can be doing. We set aside some important dollars for issues related to affordable housing and some of our communities that didn't have fully functioning emergency operations centers. And so we looked at it in a comprehensive manner. I think this coming legislature will continue to look at it, obviously, on the heels of Hurricane Michael and what occurred there in that community. That community clearly was a lot more impacted from loss of life and also from loss of property. And that speaks to building codes, and it speaks to the preparedness of that community vis-a-vis South Florida, for example. And so I think there's a lot that can be done to make sure a future storm or storms will not impact a community as devastatingly as it did Michael. But that obviously is going to be an ongoing discussion.
One other issue on, we talk about the environment. Sea level rise, climate change. You know, you live down here, and
sure,
this is a big issue for us because we're living it now. We start to see this happening. And so we've got this. The South Florida is working to become more resilient and possibly even show the world. Not something that's discussed a lot in Tallahassee. And of course, with the last governor, we never even heard the word climate change. Ron DeSantis says he's not necessarily a denier, but he definitely has a different stance on this than Andrew Gillum. But I mean, look, South Florida is trying to deal with the issue. How is Tallahassee going to help in trying to battle the issue of climate change and the oncoming ocean?
Sure. Well, and I think that's important that you bring it up, because obviously you can't have an environmental discussion without talking about sea level rise and climate change and things of that nature. But 2 years ago, we did pass legislation that asked a comprehensive work group from various areas, various state departments, to look at a number of impacts to our environment. And sea level rise was in there as part of the discussions that they wanted the state to look at. And so that work group is ongoing. That work group will provide recommendations to the next legislature, and they'll have to take a look at, you know, how does development, as we know, especially in the Brickell area, how does that impact sea level rise, and what are the issues that really Tallahassee can lead on in terms of making sure that we're addressing it, in particular for the South Florida community that sees it on a regular basis.
Let me finish with this. We've seen early voting numbers are higher than in the last midterm. We're expecting higher voter turnout this midterm than we did in 2014. And roughly 2 to 3% or so are still undecided. So to those people right now, you're speaking to them. How do you convince them that the Ron DeSantis and Jeanette Nunez ticket is the way to vote?
Well, and again, thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak to those voters in particular. If you look at our platform and if you look at our record, both Ron and myself, I've spent 8 years working in Tallahassee, championing issues that are important to my community, issues of safety and well-being, issues related to human trafficking, issues related to our economy. And I think that we have a lot to show for, but I think we also have a lot of challenges that we need to continue to move forward on. And I think it's most important that voters study the issues and see which is the ticket that's going to protect your economic prosperity? Which is the ticket that's going to make sure we're providing more opportunities for employment and more opportunities for business to grow, to relocate, to thrive? Which is the ticket that has the backing of law enforcement because they know that we're going to stand with our men and women in law enforcement? Which is the ticket that has the wherewithal and the ability to work with the federal government to bring much needed funding, hundreds of millions of dollars that we've been promised over the years, but that the federal government has forgotten Florida. And so we're going to make sure that we put Florida first. We're going to make sure that we continue to push forward policies that are going to really provide a brighter future for every Floridian. Because at the end of the day, I firmly believe that we're not just the best choice. We are truly the only choice that will protect Florida's future.
State Representative Jeanette Nunez, again, running for lieutenant governor along with Ron DeSantis on the Republican ticket. Mrs. Nunez, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much.
And you can read more of our coverage of the 2018 election and see a full guide of this year's ballot by going to amendments.wlrn.org. And we've invited Democrat Lieutenant Governor candidate Chris King to be on the program later this week. Well, still to come, it's time for a roundtable discussion of this month's Sundial Book Club title. It's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, The Veins of the Ocean is a novel by Miami-based author Patricia Engel. It's the October title of the Sundial Book Club. It's a story about a young woman named Reina Castillo who moves to a quiet corner of the Florida Keys to escape her past and try and find a new sense of home. Now, the book tackles a lot of different things like family tragedies, life in prison, and the immigrant experience. This is Engel's second novel. Now, she talked to us a couple of weeks ago about how this novel started as a short story.
For some reason, even though I write many short stories that stay as short stories, they don't turn into novels, that story, The Bridge, stayed with me in a way that other stories haven't. And I decided that I wanted to return to it in order to make it a novel.
You can hear the full interview with Engel at WLRN/programs/Sundial. Remember, you can join the Sundial Book Club, find our Facebook group page, and just ask to join. Everyone's welcome. Next week, we're going to announce the November Book Club title. In fact, today, one of our book club members is joining us on the panel. So just remember that join the book club, you could be a member of the book club and then one day be on the show with us. We're joined by Nan Klingener. She's a WLRN reporter from our southernmost bureau in Key West. Nan, always a pleasure.
Hi, Lewis.
Also joining us is Chantel Acevedo, UM professor and leader of the University of Miami's Common Book Program. This year's title is Veins of the Ocean. Chantel, great to have you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Also joining us, as I said, one of our book club members is joining us today, Libia Casas. She's a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist in private practice in Kendall, my neck of the woods. Libia, it's great to have you.
Great to be here.
All right. You know what? Let's start with this again. I just wanted to mention spoilers, spoiler alert here. We're going to be talking about the book. So if you haven't read it yet, we're going to be talking a lot about it. We might give away some stuff, but you know, if you haven't read it at this point, what can I tell you? You know what? Let me start with you, because one, it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for being a part of the club. How did this book make you feel after you were done with it?
Well, I am part of the book club, and I did see the interview with the author, and I figured I'd get it at the library because I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I had the book on my desk, and I am page 3. I was hooked. I'm like, oh my God, what am I reading?
Right off the bat.
And I guess part of it is me being a therapist in Miami and dealing with different cultures and just a lot of like dysfunction. I got suckered into this book. It's like a very much a Miami family. There's the Cuban, because in every story in Miami, there's a Cuban. But there's also the Colombian, which is not a usual combination in a lot of the books I've read, you know, written by Miami authors. So.
Right, yep, exactly. No, that's an interesting point, too. I mean, talk about dysfunction. I found myself throughout the book, I just wanted to, like, grab some of these characters and shake them and just, like, what is wrong with you?
Why especially the mother.
No, exactly. But then that's how you know the characters are really well written, when you start to feel that. Chantel, what about you? How did this book make you feel after you were done?
Oh, I think similarly to Livia, it was, it gets you right from the beginning. You know, I think outside in the green room we were talking about, page two, you're hooked. Where is it going to go from here? But I also found myself thinking a lot about the young people that I know and the ones I teach at the University of Miami, and how Reina herself is this young person in transition, and she's trying to figure out who she is. And you don't always know, you know, what a person is going through. You know, a lot of us, I think, go through life like ducks. We look so calm and serene on the surface, and we're, like, waddling or, like, swimming like crazy underneath. And everything that she goes through, the trauma, the fracture of immigration, what's happened with her brother and her father, all of that struck me as so profound and moving and sad as well.
Yeah, and you, because you talk about how the book grabs you right from the beginning. So, you know, right at the start, there's the scene where a father is throwing his child, his infant child, over a bridge. That child does survive, but that story comes back. There was an interesting point, too, in talking to Patricia Engel about that, where she got that. But let me go to Nan. Nan, I mean, and the other thing, too, about this book is that it eventually ends up in the Florida Keys. I wondered your take on this book. And by the way, Nan is like the avid reader we all want to be. She probably reads like 10 times more books than I do, and I try really hard. But I mean, Nan, for you, like this book, what was special about it?
Well, to answer your original question, I felt hopeful at the end of this book, which is really nice these days to feel hopeful. And yeah, the fact that it takes place in the Keys and it's not, you know, a wacky crime novel or it's not somebody's, you know, Jimmy Buffett tourism ad fantasy, but it's real people who live and work here year round. And it's not some paradise for them. It's the place that they live. I really, really appreciated that.
Yeah, and did Patricia do a good job? And this is one thing about her that she kept talking about, is that she does a lot of research. I mean, she when you look at, you know, all the different things that her character was doing, she was doing those things to really get a feel for it. So she spent time in the Keys. But I mean, your take on how she depicted that life?
Yeah, like I said, it was really refreshing and delightful to see a sort of real life in the Keys portrayed in a novel, as opposed to somebody's fantasy of what it, you know, could be like or should be like.
All right, so Libya, this is to me, this is a fascinating aspect, is because of your work and what you do, and so you probably get the chance to look at these characters in a way that none of us can. But I wanted your idea, your take, as you're reading through this, you're dealing with Reina and her issues. You've got a father again who throws a baby over a bridge. He goes to prison and is scheduled to be executed. So we see this, you know, this relationship between Reina and her brother play out. She's visiting him in prison every week. The relationship she has with her mother. As you're reading this, I mean, are you psychoanalyzing these characters? Are you like, oh, I've seen these people before?
Well, it's not that I've seen these people before, but I could feel empathy for them. It's like with Reina, it's like I almost wanted to go in there and take her hand and say, come here, get away from these people.
She always seems to attract just the characters, the strangest characters that you want her to stay away from.
Yes, and then she meets this guy in the parking lot, and that's like the person that she connects, and she starts working on becoming whole again. It's just, and the ending, yes, I agree, was so, there was a sense of hope.
There was. I will say this, though. I mean, maybe sometimes I just want that Hollywood ending, and that's just me. I don't know. It was a fascinating ending, a fascinating story. As I mentioned, Patricia Engel was on the program, and she told us about how she researches her books very carefully. And so she's gone deep sea diving. She's, you know, she's visited prisons. You know, there was even the scene where Reina is at the this aquarium, and she wants to save a dolphin, and she learned a lot about how dolphins end up in these places. So she really does her homework to understand these scenes. You know what, Chantal, I wanted to ask you about the University of Miami's Common Book Program and why you chose this book, but tell us about the program real quickly.
Sure, the program is in its second year, and Common Book programs are pretty common in universities across the country. The idea is that students who are coming from all over the place can gather over a book and have common conversation. The reason we picked Patricia's wonderful book is because there are so many points of entry for a book like this. And as you said at the top of the segment, it's about immigration, and it's about marine life, and it's about conservation, and it's about family trauma, and all of these things. And so the idea is that students can tackle these issues sort of via the literature and have these conversations together.
How do those conversations work, by the way? I mean, is it just you have different gathering points that, you know, throughout the semester, students come together, staff as well?
Absolutely. So it's everyone comes together. And coincidentally, our book last year was your book from last month. So you have to tell me later who next month is so that we can plan for next year.
I'm not giving anything away just yet. So I got to wait for next week.
Yes.
You'll find out. But I mean, what is it that you hope that those conversations are going to generate? What do you hope people are going to get out of it?
I think, you know, we're living in this really divided time. And for people who, again, are coming from all of these different places, who can come together and sit around a table or a conference room or outside on campus and talk about a topic that's close to their hearts. So, for example, I was in conversation with members of the Chemistry Club, and they're going to do an event on the chemistry of the ocean. And so it's not necessarily about Reina specifically, but it sort of circles the book, you know, in interesting ways, and we'll give out copies, and students hopefully will be reading it and just getting into the book and having a place from which to springboard more conversation.
But why don't you tell me how you pick the books? How do you decide on them?
Yes, well, partly we picked this book because of all of those points of entry. You know, it's just very rich, you know, with discussion. Also, Patricia is local, so that is really helpful. And she is she often teaches in the creative writing program for us. So she's a visiting writer for us this fall. And so she loves students and is an excellent teacher. And we thought, okay, we're only in our second year. Let's get someone in there who, you know, doesn't mind rolling up her sleeves and working with students and has such wisdom to impart. So.
Nan, something you said a second ago I thought was interesting is kind of what you typically get when you talk about a book that takes place in the Florida Keys. Is that really the case? Is that you typically get that, you know, the crime story and the characters are real stereotypes? Or, you know, or come on, there's got to be a good mix.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely get a lot of those. And it's probably Carl Hyacinth's fault because he has done it so well that everybody else wants to do it, too. But yeah, we do get a lot of those. What, there are other books, though.
You're you know right. what, though? I mean, is it missing the point? Because I have to admit, even though I grew up in South Florida, I've only been down to the Keys a few times. But every time I go, I think to myself, this is like another world. Like the moment I cross the bridge and I leave South Florida, I'm like, whoa, I've entered another planet.
Yeah. I mean, we are different from the mainland. There's no question. And I guess that comes through in the books as well. And there are a lot of people who come here sort of seeking to escape a past life or seeking some better life, whatever that means for them. And they don't always find it, and then they get frustrated. But
in your experience, what writer really like hits it, really gets the, you know, life in the Keys?
I am a real champion of Elizabeth Bishop, who is a poet, one of America's greatest poets, who spent some time here in the 1930s and 40s. And she's best known as a poet, but she's also a very beautiful essayist. And she has some essays from her time here that are really worth looking up if you are interested in the Keys and Key West specifically.
Again, we are talking about the Sundial Book Club. The October title is Veins of the Ocean by Patricia Engel. Just a reminder that you can listen to the interview we did with Patricia a couple of weeks ago. It's on our website, WLRN. Look up Sundial. We're talking with WLRN reporter Nan Klinginer, also Chantal Acevedo, UM professor and leader of the Common Book Program, on the UM campus, and Libia Casas, who is a book club member and a psychotherapist in practice here in Kendall, Florida. I wanted to get from all of you your take on the title. And, you know, they say don't judge a book by its cover, but I don't, the title for you, you've read the book. What does it mean to you, Libya?
Initially, I would think, if had I not heard the author speak, I thought it was kind of maybe like a little romancy kind of veins and ocean. But then after reading the book, and actually when I look at the cover, there's like red, there's blood, there's blue, there's ocean, veins, the connection with the ocean, with peoples, with cultures. So there's a lot. It's loaded. The title's loaded.
Yeah, no, it is. I thought about that too, and as I kept reading through, I started to get it. At least it hit me almost halfway through the book when she started doing the diving. Mm-hmm. That's when it's like, I think I'm starting to figure this out. But that's my take. Chantal, what about you?
I think similar ways. The novel opens, you know, with this horrific act that happens in relation to the ocean. And it kind of ends in a kind of healing ocean way. And so I think when we think of veins as being life-giving, you know, but sort of the potential of the opposite of that, right? And so the ocean gives and it takes, and it's a story of immigration, and there's people crossing the ocean, you know, to get here to this country. And I think just that sort of that dichotomy of the ocean, it's both life and death.
Yeah, Nan, your take. Titles. You've read so many books. You got titles for you. Come on.
Yeah, and I really thought it really refers to the way that the ocean sort of connects us and divides us, and that's especially true. We're very conscious of it, especially here in the Keys, with how close we are to Cuba and how far. You know, it's insanely close, and yet we're so separated from them. And obviously these characters are feeling that directly.
All right. I want all of you to stick around for after the program. I want to ask you guys about what you are reading, what books you're reading now, what books you are looking forward to for the rest of the year. We're going to post that up on our Sundial Book Club page. Again, ask to join it on Facebook. Find the Facebook group. Ask to join it. We welcome all of you. And remember, next Tuesday, I will announce the book for November. I'm not telling you yet, Chantal. Nan Kligener, again, reporter from our Southernmost Bureau in Key West, joined us today. Chantal Acevedo, UM professor and leader of the Common Book Club program at the University of Miami. And Libia Casas is a book club member and also a psychotherapist in private practice in Kendall, Florida. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Louise.
Really had a lot of fun. And remember, find us on Facebook. We'd love you to join. Now, next coming up, we're going to meet a photographer who's putting together a book about a Hialeah man who has turned trash into art. We'll explain. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We'll take a moment and try to imagine everything you've consumed over the past week. Every soda can, sandwich, pickle, you name it. Think about the past month or the past year, all that food and the trash that it produces. For one Hialeah-based artist, I should say, Rafael Salazar, collecting that trash and turning it into something beautiful has become his life project. And his home is filled with art installations created from pickle jars and soda cans that he's collected over the last few decades. Photographs documenting Mr. Salazar's incredible installations will be part of a new book curated by Luann Collodney. She's the winner of a new Ellie's Grant from the Art Center South Florida, one of 44 visual artists given money for unique projects. Collodney will be using the money to develop this book, and she joins us now. Luann, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Congratulations, by the way. This is a fascinating project. You've been friends with Mr. Salazar for a while now, right?
Oh, yes. Going back probably about 25, 30 years.
How do you describe him?
Rafael's a one-of-kind person. He's very thoughtful. He's magical. He has great vision. He's a very private person. And he is a beautiful person. Cares a lot about our ecology, which is one of the things that his project of saving bottles and containers. That's one of the reasons he does it. He wants people to always pick up, you know, after themselves. But he has obviously a quite unique vision.
Take us to his house. And we do have a few photographs that we're going to share on our Facebook page. But take us to his house. Start in the backyard. What do we see?
Oh, actually, can I start in the front yard?
Let's do the front yard. Okay. let's start there.
You drive up and it's just a little house in Hialeah, like every other house on the block, until you really look at it. And when you look at it, behind the bars that are at the front of the house, you see an upside-down bicycle hanging from the ceiling. And it's red, white, and blue. And there's a lamp that's hanging upside down. And you say, whoa, what is this? And then as you approach inside, there are three little stones that were put there by an artist friend of ours. And it's zen-like. You open the door, you walk in, and you see this narrow pathway. And on your right, from ceiling to floor, are these marvelous cascading cans of soda. You've got Sprite. There's no specificness to it. And he has created this marvelous curtain which separates the entryway into the living room. Now, when you go in the living room, it's not a gorgeous living room. It's sparsely furnished. There's one wonderful chair, a smaller chair, and a table. But all around you are these totems of bottles. There are milk bottles, the plastic containers where he's garbage, put them together with string and hung them and let them cascade down. Way in the background, you see a painting of a friend of his, a very well-known artist in Miami. And then in another place, you see a little shrine that's made up of things that his mother collected. And next to that will be things he's picked up off of the ground. And the entire house is like a labyrinth. You walk through, and every moment, every place you look, you discover something new, something charming, something thoughtful. Something alarming, even.
And so you want to create a book that tells the story.
Absolutely.
Of his work and his home, because his home is the work.
It's his life. It's actually his life.
And what do you hope that book's going to tell people about him and about his work?
In many ways, it's just so much like a wonderland. And it shows what you can do as an artist with nothing in many ways. It shows what we can do to help the ecology of our country and of the world. It shows what, if you have a vision, how you can turn, you use the word trash, how you can use everyday common objects and create something beautiful, create something thoughtful. And it's just a different way of life and of being. And if it were in another location, I think the world would grab onto it and say it's like the Coral Castle. It's this man's obsession and his preciseness of using materials.
Is he still creating?
Oh, absolutely.
Or does he, because I'm wondering, do you have any more room in the house?
Well, hurricanes help in that matter.
Yeah.
We were talking today that we want to do a panorama of the space, and it's totally different than when we photographed, because we photographed about 6 months ago. By the way, this is not just my project. It's his work. And Raphael is a photographer who has, incidentally, documented the entire art scene between the 60s and 70s at our museums through being on their staff to do that. So he's an artist in his own right. But the other thing is that I think I lost my train of thought there. Where was I going?
Well, no. I wanted to know, what is he going to do with all of this stuff? I mean, he's got it in his home, but what? At some point, you have to think about what happens to it.
I don't think that's some consideration of his at this moment. He enjoys living in it. He enjoys changing it around. The few people that he knows have enjoyed it with him, and this book is just a way to let the world know what an incredible home environment art project this can be.
Because, as you said, he's a private man, so not a lot of people have seen it.
Well, because you can't. You two people at a time can go through. I say, it's very, very circuitous.
Right.
And it's a private tour, a private thing, even if you walk through it, because you bring your own experiences to it.
What can you tell us about when we might expect the book?
I would say probably 6 months or so. That's where I was going with this. There are other people involved, and one of them is William Cordova, who is a very well-known artist in the area and nationally. He's been doing a lot of photography of the home. Ernesto Orozco, who is going to help us do the publishing of the book and getting the ISBN and doing all the technical things that have to do with it. Raphael, of course, has already done his part, but he's going to do more photography because we want to do a flip book showing how, because he's got columns, you were talking about the backyard. Right. He's got columns that are like 15, 20 feet high.
Now, some of the photos are really amazing. Luann, first of all, again, congratulations.
Thank you.
And we're looking forward to this book. But we, you know what? We're going to try to get some of those photos we want to post up on Facebook. You got to see this. This is amazing. Luann Colony, again, thank you so much. And she's one of the recipients of this year's Ellie Awards. We're waiting for that book. We'll bring you back. Talk about it.
Thank you so much.
All right. And again, it was a $10,000 grant for this photographic book on Rafael Salazar. Again, we'll get some of those photos up online. That's the program for today, this Tuesday, October 30th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Don't forget to find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.